Welcome to Ask an Atheist, a weekly educational program dedicated to atheism, skeptical inquiry, and the separation of church and state. We air live from Scan Studios in Seattle every Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and are archived online at askanatheist.tv. My name is Jerry, and joining me today is my Vulcan friend Casey. Unfortunately, you don't have your ears with you today.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that. No, I fully intended to have them. I bought them for Halloween 4 years ago, and I misplaced them somehow. Sorry.
It happens.
So you look great, though, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I had to dress up for this.
Of course.
Casey will be discussing the relationship with Star Trek and atheism. For those of you who are watching at home, by the way, you probably know the rules already. Anytime I tuck on my tunic or say, make it so, you have to say, or you have to take a drink.
Right. I wish I had my beer here, actually.
For this particular show, we'll be dispensing with our usual announcements. However, if you have any questions, even if they don't pertain to Star Trek, you're welcome to call. Our phone number is 206-421-5658. And so, switching to our topic now, many people may not be aware that Gene Roddenberry, who created Star Trek, was also a humanist. And he was named Humanist of the Year in 1988, by the American Humanist Association. For those of you who may not be aware of what humanism is, the Secular Humanist Press has a very good definition of what humanism is, and I'll go ahead and read it now. Secular humanism is a rational, non-theistic, naturalistic philosophy which supports intellectual freedom, free inquiry, self-responsibility, and scientific progress for the benefit of humankind. When applied to everyday decision-making, secular humanism provides a foundation for ethical conduct and human compassion without the need of salvation or supernatural guidance. And again, this is from the Secular Humanist Press, which is published by the Humanist Washington.
Of which you're the president. There's a little plug for you.
Oh, thank you. So anyway, I'll go ahead and turn over the topic to you.
Oh, okay. Well, I actually wanted to thank you, Jerry, for bringing up the topic. I wanted to name this Star Trek and Atheism because I was curious about the relationship between people who call themselves explicit atheists and this phenomenon of Star Trek. And you actually made a great point, which was that, this is often kind of trotted out as one of the things about atheism is, atheists, you don't believe in anything. Well, really, the scope of what it means when you're an atheist is that you just reject the positive belief that there are gods.
Right.
And all of the things that I think make Star Trek memorable about its compassion, about its reason, about its wonder for exploration, none of those have anything to do with atheism. The only thing atheism has to do with is that one question. So it is but more to say that Star Trek is a secular humanist show as well as an atheist show, which mm-hmm. we're going to go through. So I'm really glad you brought it up because obviously Gene Roddenberry himself was a huge humanist and very outspoken about that and was outspoken about wanting to create a show that did that. So I think I can just jump right in and we'll start on. So I think the first question is why is this even relevant? Why is Star Trek relevant to a discussion about atheism? And I think that even though we're kind of showing our nerd flag here by mm-hmm. showing up in uniform and being on the bridge of the Enterprise D right behind us, what I think is really relevant is that if you talk to self-identified atheists, you'll find that almost all of them are either fond of or huge fans of Star Trek, and I wanted to know why that was. And whether it's an appeal to kind of a narrative that's more intellectual, you know, because we like to have heroes that are not strong, that are smart. I mean, that's a kind of atypical kind of hero, usually grounded in science fiction, because science fiction is obviously a very it appeals to a future wherein we don't have to go through the apocalypse to get through. It can be the design of rational human planning. And I think lastly is that maybe it's because Star Trek fans are this kind of large, self-selected outcast group, and that certainly describes what atheism is. I mean, we're mm-hmm. a minority, we're self-selected, and we're in this group that basically gets kicked out. And I think amongst like the various themes that are in Star Trek, I think the fact that religious belief is almost completely absent except in the cultures they visit, I think this is clearly by design. Gene Roddenberry was quoted in an article in one of the humanist magazines of saying that, I guess from that time in his teenage years, it was clear to me that religion was largely nonsense, largely magical and superstitious things. So, I mean, even personally, Gene Roddenberry was clearly a skeptic and an atheist.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say for myself, I grew up literally watching the original series. And I just remember, even when I actually was theoretically a Catholic at the time, I just couldn't buy into the belief in a God, especially right. given what I was seeing on the show.
Right.
It just made more sense for me to right. to dispense with or so, to not compartmentalize that.
Right. There was kind of a reinforcement by that.
Exactly.
It's so funny because, I mean, it's often trotted out about that being secular humanist, but I mean, as far as it being explicitly atheist, I actually went and found some quotes from two guys who actually produced the show after Gene Roddenberry died. One is Ronald D. Moore, which people know as the creator of Battlestar Galactica, and mm-hmm. He's very, very highly praised. And he said of Gene Roddenberry that he felt very strongly that all of our contemporary Earth religions would be gone by the 23rd century. And while few of us around here share that opinion, he means the writers, we feel that we should leave this part of the Trek universe alone. It's the core tenet of Gene's Trek. And Brandon Braga, who also was a writer and producer, said, in Gene Roddenberry's future, no single human being on Earth believes in any sort of nonsense that has plagued our civilization for thousands of years. Everyone is an atheist, and the world is better for it. So, I mean, the people who write and produce the show literally say, these human beings are atheists. So, I mean, I guess it's not surprising that a world crafted by Gene Roddenberry, who he was, is built around these concepts that have this rejection of religious interpretation of the way the universe is. And I thought that I could try to approach identifying why this perspective sort of aligns with mm-hmm. atheism or secular humanism in sort of broad categories that I know more about, which is the three categories of philosophy, which are metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics. And I'll right. explain to you why those are, and then we'll basically have some examples of these from the show.
Okay.
The first is metaphysics, which is that's the concept of in philosophy about trying to explain what the universe is like and what being. So essentially existence, objecthood, property, space, causality, these are all things that would fall underneath the realm of metaphysics. That eventually became natural philosophy, which is now the domain of science, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the nature of the Star Trek universe is one where, obviously, it's grounded in a material universe where only the material things exist, and those things which appear to not be material, like when big, crazy space alien comes up and is behaving like a god, they find the reason why. Either it's a more advanced alien or they're using technology, but there's nothing supernatural going on. It's all natural, and it's explained, kind of like the Scooby-Doo ending.
Right.
You know? That's part and parcel of... they exist in our universe, right? Our history is the shared history of Star Trek, and so they're trying to be living in our universe, and that universe is a rational and material one.
Mm-hmm.
The second point that I actually want to point out is that in its epistemology, and that is the area that deals with human knowledge and belief, as we've said, every human being in Star Trek is an atheist. And as part of the, I think this is probably one of the most commendable parts, is that on Star Trek, the characters are constantly want to self-improve. And it's about learning knowledge for knowledge's sake, exploring the galaxy, and doing it in a way that essentially explodes anthropocentrism, right? Because they're in a universe where the galaxy is populated by many number of species, and so they have to necessarily jettison those ideas mm-hmm. about them being the most powerful or the most special one in the universe.
And then your third point about ethics.
Right. And ethics, which of course is this field which deals with morality, I think the ethics that Star Trek kind of gets on is that we've kind of got over our internal wars, we've got over exploitation and economics and bigotry and oppression, so that we now have sort of this universal tolerance. They let any aliens who want to be in the Federation. And each story itself is kind of a morality play where they, you know, they kind of say, try to get over their prejudices or aliens' prejudices and try to come to this kind of harmony, which makes sense because the show was actually, you know, started in the 60s, and so mm-hmm. you could see a lot of those values, hippie kind of values.
Right. Well, and it was also based in during the Vietnam War, so you can right. really see the interplay between what was going on at that time, especially
right.
with the political chaos that we had during that time. And many of those ideas were written into the show.
Right, absolutely. And we're actually going to see a few of these later. I just want to make note that obviously this was kind of a living organism because it developed from being kind of this weird, campy show that looked kind of like a weird Western and had lots of mm-hmm. crazy stuff to when it became The Next Generation and beyond. It grew and changed and became something different. And I think it's important for us to sort of talk about the differences.
Right. Well, and of course, also during the time, the Western was very popular on TV. I think there were at least 20 Westerns going on at that time,
right,
or that were on television.
Right.
So there was a lot of those same themes. And I recall hearing that they were required to have at least 2 minutes of action or violence for every 15 minutes of show.
Of course.
So it was, for Gene Roddenberry, this was very difficult for him to have to work with. And he was very glad to finally be able to get away from that when he was able to produce his own show.
Right.
And that, of course, was The Next Generation.
Right. So I think, you know, I've tried to cover these three sorts of things, and I've done them in very broad ways. So I want to go ahead and start. Actually, if it might be possible, I want the booth to load up clip number one, because essentially I think I want to show you how these three characteristics about sort of the believing in a naturalistic universe and there being no supernatural, sort of this elimination of absolute certainty and an exploration of knowledge, as well as kind of a universal ethics, comes into play. And I think from the clip, this is from Next Generation's Who Watches the Watchers, I think we'll sort of explain all of these things wrapped up into a single bundle. So, Jerry?
Engage.
Doctor, you believe the Mintarkans are capable of harming Counselor Troy?
Well, they are not normally a violent people, but these are extraordinary circumstances. They're trying to comprehend what they believe to be a god.
Recommendations?
The Mintarkans wish to please the Overseer, but they can only guess what he wants. They need a sign.
Are you suggesting...
You must go down to Mintarka 3.
Masquerading as a god?
Absolutely out of the question. The Prime Directive...
has already been violated. The damage is done. All we can do now is minimize it.
By sanctioning their false beliefs?
By giving them guidelines. Letting them know what the Overseer expects of them.
Dr. Baron, I cannot, I will not impose a set of commandments on these people. To do so violates the very essence of the Prime Directive.
Like it or not, we have rekindled the Mintarkans' belief in the Overseer.
And are you saying that this belief will eventually become a religion?
It's inevitable. And without guidance, that religion could degenerate into inquisitions, holy wars, chaos.
Horrifying. Dr. Baron, your report describes how rational these people are. Millennia ago, they abandoned their belief in the supernatural. Now you are asking me to sabotage that achievement, to send them back into the dark ages of superstition and ignorance and fear? No! We will find some way to undo the damage we've caused.
Liko, you don't want to kill me.
I have no choice. I must do as the Picard wishes.
Are you sure you know what he wants? That's a problem with believing in a supernatural being. Trying to determine what he wants.
We must do something.
But what if it's the wrong thing, Father?
Picard, we need your guidance. Is it your wish that this woman should die? Answer us. Speak.
Liko.
The Picard. You are the Overseer. I will prove it.
Liko!
If you believe I'm all-powerful, then you cannot hurt me. If, however, I am telling the truth, and I am mortal, you will kill me. But if the only proof you will believe is my death, then shoot.
Liko, don't do it! Father, no!
This is one of my favorite episodes of all time. In fact, a number of years ago, we actually had a program where we aired this particular episode. It was just one of the more powerful examples of how Gene Roddenberry's vision of what he would like to achieve.
Right. Well, I think what's the most important here is that I think that this sort of wraps up all of the different things that I was talking about, because obviously There's no gods in this universe. It's not ethical for him. They have got their prime directive, which basically forbids them. Their mm-hmm. highest laws forbids them from doing it. And of course, Picard personally won't do this. And so they need to try to find a way to reconcile this, even though the fact that they've already disturbed their culture. And I think it's, his speech is heavy-handed there when he sort of talks about the ignorance and fear and whatnot. But I really think that does reflect. I mean, Gene Roddenberry was alive when they wrote and made this episode. So I think this really does reflect Gene Roddenberry's sort of ideal view of what he wishes he could do. And this is the interesting part, is that I wanted to take these, and so I've spent all this time propping all of these up, and I want to actually take some time finding examples in the giant swath of the Star Trek universe to play you counterexamples. Because while I think it actually represents these things, sometimes Star Trek doesn't say these things. In fact, sometimes it says the opposite.
Do you think there were viewers who were offended, though, by that episode?
Oh, I'm sure there were. I mean, obviously, it was basically telling everyone who was a theist that they're superstitious and ignorant, right?
It's hard to avoid, of course, in that particular case. By the way, I just want to remind people again, this is, of course, a live show, and you're welcome to call us with any questions you have. Our phone number is 206-421-5658.
Right. As I put down here, while all these ideals that I've talked about are sort of fundamental to this beloved universe that we know of, I think these ideals are stillborn because they are either not ever fully developed, I think it reaches its pinnacle here, or in the series, or sometimes they're compromised at the behest of drama, or they're just outright ignored, which happens in shows with multiple writers. And I just want to go back through the list and say the reasons why they were praiseworthy before, and then actually the reasons why they sometimes get completely obliterated. The first is that in the metaphysics of the show, sometimes the show is about exploring the mysterious, and Starfleet and the Enterprise is often like the galactic mythbusters. So, they'll go to your local planet, and whoever's pretending to be God, they'll go and they'll pull the curtain, and you'll see the guy, pulling the levers and stuff.
And, well, there's always a computer that they have to disable because it has, of course, taken over the society, and it's no longer following a natural course of evolution.
Right. But, I mean, there are sometimes where they'll be dismissive of mysticism, or it'll be something part of their culture. Like, for example, I think Chakotay in Voyager has this weird little e-meter that he uses to, you know what I'm talking about? He's got a little technological device that allows him to, see his spirit creature or something. And, Janeway and the whole crew just sort of indulges him in his weirdness, even though he's literally just inducing himself to hallucinate. So sometimes they just overlook these sorts of things in general.
Which character was that again?
Chakotay,
first
officer.
Yes.
Yeah. But I have a clip here in where I think that this is of the Next Generation also, of a show called Who Watches the, or excuse me, where Silence Has Lease, where the Enterprise is basically doomed. They're trapped for a powerful alien who basically want to kill half the crew. And Picard's solution is to say, we're not giving you what you want, so we're going to set the auto-destruct, basically. And so this is Picard going into his room, sort of living out his last moments and ruminating on the fact that he's about to die. So if you would go ahead and roll number two whenever you can get to it.
Make it so.
I have a question, sir.
Yes, Data, what is it?
What is death?
Oh, is that all? Well, Data, you're asking probably the most difficult of all questions. Some see it as a changing into an indestructible form, forever unchanging. They believe that the purpose of the entire universe is to then maintain that form in an earth-like garden, which will give delight and pleasure through all eternity. On the other hand, there are those who hold to the idea of our blinking into nothingness. With all of our experiences and hopes and dreams, merely a delusion.
Which do you believe, sir?
Considering the marvelous complexity of the universe, its clockwork perfection, its balances of this against that, matter, energy, gravitation, time, dimension, I believe that our existence must be more than either of these philosophies. That what we are goes beyond Euclidean or other practical measuring systems, and that our existence is part of a reality beyond what we understand now as reality.
Yeah, so my point in showing that is that's completely 180 what Picard should actually be, mm-hmm. right? He's making an argument for intelligent design right there. Am I right?
Yes.
He's saying, oh, look at how naturally ordered the universe is and all of these sorts of things. Like, to me that essentially destroys the view that I have of Picard, because he's basically saying, oh, it must be all more than these things. Well, by what standard? By nothing. It's completely an argument from ignorance, right? Mm-hmm. He's talking about a complete mystery. So, and that was very un-Picard for me, you know. Yeah. And I think that completely violates what we know of who watches the Watchers, what we know of Picard, and how he feels about that. So I don't know. Maybe he was in delusion. I don't know.
Well, there was certainly a strong component to that episode. They were literally faced with losing their lives.
Right.
But still, yes, I agree with you. That was not consistent with what we know right. of Picard.
So this is an example of how sometimes different writers, or for situational parts, they just jettison entirely. Mm-hmm. So the second part here, and this is the most relevant to our discussion, is the epistemology of the show and sometimes where it gets it wrong. I mean, the show tries to explore many different perspectives in different cultures, but in that way they get to have characters like the Bajorans on Deep Space Nine, which are they all have this strong religion that helps them get through, but really the religion is based around them worshiping wormhole aliens, right? Characters that we know to just be powerful aliens, essentially. I think this, sometimes the characters don't live up to Roddenberry's vision, especially when it comes to belief. And the first example that you'll have right here is where they really get it wrong. This is number three for the booth, and this is Who Mourns for Adonis from the original series.
Engage. I'll take a drink.
Come here. I know you're trying to escape me. It's useless. I know everything you do. I try to be compassionate toward your kind.
You know nothing about our kind. You know only our remote ancestors who tremble before your tricks. Your tricks don't frighten us, neither do you. We've come a long way in 5,000 years.
But you're still of the same nature. I could sweep you out of existence with a wave of my hand and bring you back again. I can give life or death. What else does mankind demand of its gods?
Mankind has no need for gods. We find the one quite adequate.
So, yes, thanks, Kirk. I think he's going to go, he's going to go on Sunday and he's going to go, fumble his rosaries around and do some genuflection, mm-hmm. I think.
I always found this particular episode to be rather ridiculous that... It just seemed really strange that they would say we don't have any need for a god, and then suddenly say but the one.
Right.
So it just seemed disingenuous.
Right, and this actually buttresses nicely with the clip number four, which is from the original series show Breads and Circuses, and they've just gone to a planet that has mirrored Roman times, but Roman times in the 20th century, and they're helped by these followers, they're worshippers of the sun. So go ahead and play clip number four, please.
Gentlemen.
Captain, I see on your report Flavius was killed. I am sorry. I like that huge sun worship. I wish we could have examined that belief of his more closely. It seems illogical for a sun worshiper to develop a philosophy of total brotherhood. Sun worship is usually a primitive superstition religion.
I'm afraid you have it all wrong, Mr. Spock, all of you. I've been monitoring some of their old-style radio waves. The Empire spokesman trying to ridicule their religion. But he couldn't. But don't you understand? It's not the sun up in the sky. It's the Son of God.
Caesar and Christ, they had them both. And the word is spreading only now.
A philosophy of total love and total brotherhood that will replace their imperial Rome But it will happen in their 20th century.
Wouldn't it be something to watch, to be a part of? To see it happen all over again. Mr. Chekhov, take us out of orbit, ahead, warp factor one.
Hi, sir.
I just love how they're so happy. They're all like, yay, Christ is coming back.
Well, I think I have to go into full atheist mode here and just say that I just find it hard to believe that people who have such a fundamental background in science would be saying things like that and would not be actually questioning those beliefs or have a good understanding or foundation for questioning those beliefs.
Right. Well, I mean, is it really a philosophy of total love and brotherhood? I mean, that's a pretty bold claim. I think, this buttresses well with the next clip, because I think the biggest offender there isn't how Kirk and all of them, and even Chekhov, is all smiling because, oh, look at how Jesus is coming. It's the fact that I think Spock remains incredulous to this whole thing. So the next clip is 005. This is from Star Trek V, directed by the indomitable William Shatner, wherein they go and meet God, essentially. So if we can go ahead and make that one go.
Engage.
Is this the voice of God?
One voice, many faces. Does this better suit your expectations? And how did you breach the barrier?
With a starship.
This starship? Could it carry my wisdom beyond the barrier?
It could, yes.
Then I shall make use of this starship.
It will be your chariot.
Excuse me.
It will carry my power to every corner of creation.
Excuse me, I'd just like to ask a question. What does God need with a starship?
Bring the ship closer.
I said, what does God need with a starship? Jim, what are you doing? I'm asking you a question.
Who is this creature?
Who am I? Don't you know? Aren't you God?
He has his doubts.
You doubt me?
I seek proof. Jim, you don't ask the Almighty for his ID.
Then here is the proof you seek.
Cosmic thoughts, gentlemen.
We were speculating. Is God really out there?
Maybe he's not out there, Bones. Maybe he's right here. Human heart. Spock?
I was thinking of Sabok.
Yeah, so I lay the blame not only on the complete conceit of that Kirk says, which is that if there's a God, it must be he must be inside of us, and it must be the human heart. What mm-hmm. And also that Spock has nothing to say. What the guy who's the most logical dude in the universe just has nothing to say. You know.
Well, he does seem to kind of sigh, though.
Well, I mean, but that's why we included the part there, is he was sighing because he lost his brother, essentially, mm-hmm. not because he was obviously distracted. So, but for these instances, Spock is like, he just like, well, we'll just let it alone. I think that's completely out of character for Spock, and I think totally antipodes to the what Roddenberry was trying to create. So I think these are you know, just little selections in the grander scope of them. But I think they're worthy of actually looking at and paying attention to, because they don't seem to fit. They do not seem to buttress with the rest of the series.
Well, of course, and after this after this movie, they of course came up with the rule, never let the captain direct.
Right.
So that was the aftermath of this particular movie.
That's true. So we just have the phone number up again. So
yes, 206-421-5658. And again, you're welcome to call in with any questions. They don't have to necessarily deal with Star Trek. And you can also email us at askanatheist.tv.
Right. And so we'll quickly move to the last bit. So just talking about the ethics and how I think they get betrayed. I think they're usually morality mm-hmm. plays, right? Most of these episodes are kind of about the Starfleet coming in and then seeing an injustice and trying to right the wrong, you know. And I think they have to create this immediate sense of right or wrong to be able to give a story that the audience can pick up in 45 minutes, you know. What I think this does with the ethics is that I think it gets very muddled. And sometimes they play with this and sometimes they don't. I mean, there is too much in Star Trek of just like them like blowing away people. Like it happens an awful lot. It happens a lot more than it should mm-hmm. for you know something that's trying to be ethical. But the episode that I have to show here is also from the original series. They're really picking on the original series about.
But it was so campy though.
Well,
you have
well.
To.
So this is from A Private Little War, and it's basically they go into a situation where the Klingons are arming these two little primitive peoples, and then, of course, the Federation decides to arm them in return with muskets and stuff. So, and how this can sort of get by as good behavior for Starfleet to actually do without the Prime Directive, without violating the Prime Directive, I don't know. So we can play clip number 6.
Do I have to say it? It's not bad enough there's already one serpent in Eden teaching one side about gunpowder. You're going to make sure they all know about it.
Exactly. Each side receives the same knowledge and the same type of firearm.
Have you gone out of your mind? Yes, maybe you have. Tari's wife, she said there was something in that root. She said now that you can refuse her nothing.
Superstition.
Is it a coincidence? This is exactly what she wants.
Is it? She wants superior weapons. That's the one thing neither side can have. Bones. Bones, the normal development of this planet was the status quo between the hill people and the villagers. The Klingons changed that with the flintlocks. If this planet is to develop in the way it should, we must equalize both sides again.
Jim, that means you're condemning this whole planet to a war that may never end. It could go on for year after year, massacre after massacre.
All right, Doctor! All right, say I'm wrong. Say I'm drugged. Say the woman drugged me. What is your sober, sensible solution to all this?
I don't have a solution. But furnishing them firearms is certainly not the answer.
Bones, do you remember the 20th century brush wars on the Asian continent? Two giant powers involved, much like the Klingons and ourselves. Neither side felt that they could pull out.
Yes, I remember. Went on bloody year after bloody year.
Well, what would you have suggested? That one side arm its friends with an overpowering weapon? Mankind would never have lived to travel space if they had. No. The only solution is what happened back then.
Yeah, which there's so much part there that's offensive because they're obviously making a sidelong reference to the Vietnam War, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they right. obviously are. And he's saying, you know, Kirk's saying, if we want them to develop the way it should, by whose standard? Like, by Kirk's personal standard of how right. they should be, that our whole society should develop? And then his sort of like, of course, they're writing this, and we're still in the middle of the Vietnam War, but he's basically saying, oh, the only way it could happen is if America, was arming, you know, there. And obviously that was clearly the solution, and it's the only way it could have happened, which is part of them projecting forward, right? Like, I think that was sort of their optimism. I don't think mm-hmm. they could have made an overt Vietnam protest show without getting some real flack. But I mean, the kind of just the conceit involved in those sorts of things, I think, is so antiposed to the type of sort of ethical standards by which they set up with the Prime Directive, and that, like, you know, Picard would never right. Picard would not do this. It's just it was such absurd.
It was such a violation of the Prime Directive. And yeah. yes, I agree with you. Picard would never have done that. In fact, I think we saw that in the previous clip.
Right, right. So we're getting towards the end here. It's funny because I had a good conversation with Matt Dillahunty, who was on our sister show, Atheist Experience, about this Voyager episode, which we're not going to show, called Tuvix, and it's kind of about how people are you know, regularly make completely monstrous decisions, like. So decisions that even objectively, even outside of the drama in the episode, are terrible, and these are just sort of commonplace. These mm-hmm. sort of when the captain just decides, you're dead, you're dead, you're dead, and there's, like, no accountability. You know,
right.
It's just sort of, like, just total authority.
And so what was the plot of this episode?
It was Tuvix. It was like Tuvok and Neelix get beamed in an accident and get fused into one person. But they become a wholly new personality. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially like the other two are dead and this one's there. And because they find out how to put them back into two people, like she basically has to condemn someone to die. And she mm-hmm. does. Like she has no... She has no right whatsoever to be saying she's a monster. I mean, she right. literally is a monster.
I definitely agree with that. So why would you say Star Trek is worth defending then?
Well, I think, I mean, of course, it's still something that's going on, right? It's the new movie came out, which we can dispense making judgments on it because I've got a lot of things, and I actually don't think it really... It intentionally tries to not follow the universe, and I actually think it... lays to waste most of the things that I've been talking about for the sake of having a cliffhanger movie. But for the original series and the series that came after it, for the most part, I think there's still this paragon of the ideal, their outlook on the future and the potential of humanity. I think that's still important. And also a very prescient warning about what would happen if we can't prepare for what we need to be prepared for if we go out into space. So it's certainly an aging relic of the 20th century, and we could throw it away entirely. But I think the themes are universal, and the characters are universally recognized in our media. And, you know, with the film this for last year, it's not going away anytime soon. And I think that atheists should own this. I think it should be something that they should grab onto, since it's so well recognized, and say, yes, this is the type of entertainment that has a message that can transcend all of the hullabaloo. Mm-hmm. And so I think how I kind of reconcile these contradictions is that, you know, Star Trek is made, written by many different people. It's made by Americans for Americans. And so we have this, we get a broader view of history and experience from the 60s to now, right? Like, we know, like, this is how we can talk so decisively about why what Kirk was saying in that last clip was so stupid, was so completely wrongheaded and conceited. But I think these stories are, and I hesitate to use this, but it's worth pointing out, is that they're kind of like the authors of the New Testament, right? They're different people from different times and places trying to put their own attachment, their own perspective on this one central idea. I mean, they do call it canon, by the way. Mm-hmm. There is a canon in Star Trek. But they're Americans. It's for an American audience. And I think some of these conceptions that are in there are kind of like exceptionalism, which they are definitely right. behave like they're exceptional, carry over by being American.
Right. Well, and do you remember growing up hearing the term manifest destiny? I heard that many, many times growing up, but I think right. it's become very un-PC now. However, I believe that the term has been replaced by American exceptionalism.
Right.
And
right.
how often do you hear the phrase on God's green earth?
Right. Yeah. And there was definitely, obviously, a religious component to that. Mm-hmm. But I think so. My thesis essentially is it's something worth holding on to because it's something that, despite the fact that it's contradictory, that there are some issues. I think there's still good lessons to be learned there, and it's just a damn fine show. Mm-hmm. I think.
Oh.
So
definitely.
I'm being urged strongly to read our viewer email here. So. Let's do the magic of, oh, how'd this happen? Stephen B. writes, where did this come from and how is it related to Spock? What about the Vulcan salute? Where did this, live long and prosper? That was, where did live long and prosper come from? I don't know. I actually don't know. That's an interesting question that I don't know much about enough about the lore of the series to know. The Vulcan salute was something that was made up by Leonard Nimoy, actually. I think mm-hmm. he totally yeah. completely invented it.
As did the Vulcan nerve pinch.
Right, right.
My understanding was that they didn't want, it was just not elegant for Spock to be punching people.
No, well.
So they wanted to find some way that would be more, that would better fit his stature.
Right, right. was it priestly blessing from a Jewish tradition? Now that would make sense because, you know, Leonard Nimoy was Jewish. This is Becky, our excellent camera member, who said that apparently this has come from Jewish tradition, which I'm actually not very surprised about because, you know, Spock is Jewish. As much as we want to think that he's Vulcan, he's totally Jewish. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Stephen. I don't know about Live Long and Prosper, but I'll definitely look it up. I think that really comes to the end. There's some other clips that I know that we have that we could play here that could... there's some other stuff that you wanted to talk about, but so I want to turn it over to you and see what you have to say, Jerry.
Well, I wanted to ask you, which character, especially from the Next Generation cast, or I'm sorry, from the Next Generation show, do you feel like you most identify with?
Well, I would say, you know, it would have to be Captain Picard. And I think it's only because they write him as literally, like, the most ethical person in the whole universe, right? I mean, he's at least the most ethical human being because he's the captain of the flagship, so he's the one that they send out to go out and do the most dangerous and rewarding things. And over and over and over again, he shows that he will sacrifice himself to do the right thing. I mean, seeing Who Watches the Watchers was a great example because he was so comfortable with being that he told the Leko, the guy, you if the only proof you demand is my death, then so be it. Then he'll kill me essentially. Like, how much of pure ideals is that, you know, in that character? So he's someone to look up to, I think, for that reason, is that even though he's a fictional character, he's something to aspire to.
Mm-hmm. Did we happen to include the clip from that, or from the end of the episode?
Oh, from Skin of Evil?
Yes.
Yes. I don't know if they can, the booth might be able to prepare the clip for Skin of Evil, which is should be included there. But go ahead and talk about your character.
Well, I guess for myself, I probably identify, well, first of all, probably with, with Wesley Crusher was one of the first people I would say that I kind of identify with. And that's probably because I find that sometimes I annoy people and can rub them a wrong way. Another character.
Is that what's a central part of Wesley's character, is that he's annoying?
It just turned out that way. It wasn't written to be that way, of course. Another character I really enjoyed was Barclay, Reginald Barclay, especially in the episode The Nth Degree. This is the one where he acquires super intelligence. But I guess I find that the character I identify with the most is Data. And I think it's because I feel that we actually are more like a computer or even an automaton than we like to give credit. I think that we have the ability to program our own minds, if you want to call it if you want to think of our minds as a software to our brain's hardware. And to me, it just seems like we should be able to examine our faults, look at our flaws, and be able to find ways to literally reprogram our own own brains.
Right. We can actually put the phone number back up again, guys, because we haven't got any calls yet, and some of you might be dying to call in. That's 206-421-5658. We've actually got quite a few emails coming in, and I think another one. And through the magic of technology, Robert from Daggett, California, says that his enjoyment of Star Trek is due to the fact that it does its best to completely remove itself of mysticism. We talked about that. I also wanted to say that the clip you showed from that Always Classic episode shows the problem with not investigating, and I wanted to ask, I don't know if he's talking about the very first one, Who Watches the Watchers. Do you think, as I do, that theists often fail to look beyond the words spoken by preachers and don't seek genuine reality? I mean, what do you think? Do theists not look at
Well, I think it's kind of avoidance of reality.
Yeah.
That it's escapism, which is kind of interesting because watching an episode of Star Trek is in itself a form of escapism.
Right.
But the difference, of course, is knowing what is reality and what is fantasy.
Right. And I think, you know, I mentioned this before. This actually, I think it's, you know, the Trekkers and Trekkies is a pretty interesting debate, right? I mean, which it's a variable that's a spongy definition. We don't really know what it is. I mean, I would say, I've always said that it's like a Trekkie is kind of like a Trekkie and a Trekker. A Trekkie is kind of like a hippie, right? So they're the ones that you would associate with going weird and crazy and dressing up and having a loose grip on reality. Whereas I would say a Trekker is just someone who likes Star Trek to varying degrees, but doesn't necessarily internalize all that fanaticism. Mm-hmm. And what if we're using that definition, the thing that I find about Trekkies is I have the same type of suspicion that I have about people who are fundamentalists simply because they lose their grip on reality. I mean, that's the danger mm-hmm. here. I mean, we have been talking about this all the time. Obviously, you and I have watched an awful lot of them and have watch those to the exclusion of other things because we've seen so much of it. But losing grip on reality is the hardest part. And where Star Trek is a danger to the people who are Trekkies are the kinds that don't think that, you know, the, like the woman who went to jury duty with her with her uniform
wearing
shirt
her uniform
on,
just like this.
The commander, I don't remember what her name was. Like, there are some serious problems that ended up there, and I think these are the ability for people who are Trek fanatics to become in the same level of fanatical zealots, religious zealots, is the temptation is there too. And like I alluded to before, there's such a thing as canon. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a word we borrow from, you know, from New Testament scripture. There's an idea about being canonical and not canonical, and people really care about what is canon and what isn't. And these ideas all smack of kind of a belief, a kind of a faith belief in stuff. So we need to be careful to like tell us that no, it's just a TV show, but you can learn something from it, you know.
And so you obviously would rather refer to yourself as a Trekker then?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously, like I said, since the definition is variable, it doesn't matter, but I would say, given that I'm not, like, I don't go to conventions and whatnot, yes, I would be a Trekker.
Yeah. Well, I will admit, I did go to one convention one time. In fact, Patrick Stewart was at that convention, and it was sort of disappointing for me because he actually alluded to being very religious.
Really?
And so that was something that I could have done without knowing.
What a jerk.
Yeah, it was somewhat disappointing.
Yeah. So I don't know if we have Skin of Evil, if we don't have any phone calls coming in, if we have Skin of Evil on to queued up there, we could run it. If not, we could probably just keep going.
Sure.
The point.
So what
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, what is your favorite Star Trek episode?
That's difficult. Oh, I think it has to be Best of Both Worlds. I think it does have to be Best of Both Worlds, and that was literally the part where Picard has to become his own enemy and then has to be saved back from the dark side, essentially, and come back to being a real human being. And I think it's good. I think it's good largely because it's the that's the confrontation with the terrifying other, right? Like he's a whole human being, and then his personality gets completely obliterated. So apparently we have actually the Skin of Evil ready to go. So if you want to do the honors.
Engage.
Captain, I've read the report that you submitted to Admiral Brooks last year regarding the Borg you called Hugh. And I've been trying to figure out why you let him go.
I thought that I had made that clear.
As I understand it, you found a single Borg at a crash site, brought it aboard the Enterprise, studied it, analyzed it, and eventually found a way to send it back to the Borg with a program that would have destroyed the entire collective once and for all. But instead, you nursed the Borg back to health, treated it like a guest, gave it a name, and then sent it home. Why?
When Hugh was separated from the Borg collective, he began to grow, to evolve into something other than an automaton. He became a person. When that happened, I felt I had no choice but to respect his rights as an individual.
Of course you had a choice. You could have taken the opportunity to rid the Federation of a mortal enemy, one that has killed tens of thousands of innocent people and which may kill even more.
No one is more aware of the danger than I am. But I'm also bound by my oath and my conscience to uphold certain principles. I will not sacrifice them in order
to... Your priority is to safeguard the lives of Federation citizens, not to wrestle with your conscience. I want to make it clear that if you have a similar opportunity in the future, an opportunity to destroy the Borg, you are under orders to take advantage of it. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
Well, that wasn't Skin of Evil, but it kind of buttressed in what we were saying.
Yeah. Well, I, of course, I do like the formalism. I mean, even at the very end, Picard does follow orders.
Right. Which, that's actually an interesting subject. I actually have wanted to ask Matt Dillahunty this, and that's, I think I always thought there was a contradiction. This shows a contradiction that exists sort of in the ethics there, which is Picard actually should not have given up the opportunity to kill them. Consider the weight on his conscience of what we actually know ends up happening later, which is that the Borg actually do go out and they do kill millions more people. Actually, millions more people die. And he's not willing to do it because I guess it's genocide, I guess. But then again, like, you know, I think he makes the wrong decision there, but he does it for his ethics. But I think that I don't think he would have, given the militarism, the fact that they are in the military and he is charged with defending them. I feel like that wasn't reasonable. I think it was emotional, but I don't think it was reasonable.
Right. Well, and I think that that kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of the humanistic principles that Gene Roddenberry wanted to stress so much on, right, on the show. And so in this case, it was consistent with that, even if it wasn't necessarily how you would predict it, right, that such an episode would, or such a situation would carry out.
Right. Yeah, and I was getting back to sort of the form, the chain of command, and the militarism stuff. I actually found one thing that is often also a part where there's a highly contradictory and problematic part to them being a military organization, mm-hmm, because there's the I follow orders no matter what, and then of course the characters always don't follow orders, right? Mm-hmm. The characters, when it comes to that, comes to the point when they have to actually make a tough ethical decision, they just like don't follow orders, and they do it because from the storyline we know what's right. We obviously, mm-hmm, know what's right. And I've always thought this about people who kind of Euthyphro's dilemma when we're dealing with God. Would you, if he was God and he told you to do something that was terrible, like, I don't know, kill your own child, would you do it because he was God? Would you follow his orders?
Well, obviously not. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why the...
Well, you wouldn't, but I mean, people who say, you know, God is the creator of the universe would say otherwise. And I think this extends to a totally personal conviction that I have, which is, I think the deferment of one's own choice, one's own ability to make their own decisions, there's no virtue in it. So I'm someone who personally believes that that if you go into the military, you are basically signing up, as Picard is doing, you're basically signing up to have you not be able to make your own ethical choices anymore, mm-hmm, right? Because you have to follow orders. And right. I think there's a valid criticism there, which is the same type of criticism that you would have for a theist, which is why would you ever want to willfully go into a situation, put yourself in a situation where you're required to not be able to make your own decisions? As an ethical person, I would say otherwise. So we actually have a call, inexplicably. Michael from Seattle. Are you there, Michael?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good.
What do you got for us, Michael?
Well, I'm just curious how you have the faith to believe there's no God. How do you believe that? Like, I'm not convinced of anything. How do you know for sure there's no God? I mean,
Michael, I don't say that I know for sure there is no God. All I say is that I reject the people's claims that say that they do know for sure that there is a God.
And that there just isn't any evidence. Agreement.
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry, say that again, Michael.
I said it sounds like we're in complete agreement. I'm not a fan of religion or, fundamentalism. If anything, I've learned to be more flexible. As a child, I was probably more fundamentalist.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who would be called as strong atheists, and strong atheists actually believe without absolute certainty, but they believe that there are no gods, and that's actually my position, but I have no evidence to suggest that. I only have my intuition. I'm an atheist straight up in that I don't have a positive belief, but I'm also on top of that a strong atheist in that, based on things that I don't have evidence for, I think it's less likely that a God exists, mm-hmm, that a God doesn't exist, rather than one that does. But I can't provide any evidence for that.
There's a lot of evidence for. If you break down the universe, it all breaks down real simply. You know, there's the matter and the fluid. Okay.
Sorry about that, Michael. You still there?
How do you know consciousness and the
We're having problems with our audio.
We're having problems with the audio, so can you re-ask that?
We're just automatons, and it's all chemistry. How does ethics or consciousness even make any sense?
Well, I mean, it makes practical. I mean, there's some practical sense to existence. I mean, we talked about epistemology before. That's one of my subjects. There's that old problem in philosophy that you only know that you exist, and that you have no way to prove that anyone else other than yourself exists. But I think these are non-problems, and everyone knows why, is that even though we may not understand logically why this doesn't happen, we have to act as if, right? So yeah. I think they're interesting problems to be talked about, but they're not something that should keep you from getting out of bed in the morning.
Hey, absolutely. I just see, like, if with the absence of some kind of deity aspect, I don't see how consciousness or any of this ethical or how does that even happen? Right. I mean, if we're just automatons.
Well, I'm really glad you called in, Michael. I'm sorry. I'm really glad you called in, but we're really running short on time. So,
okay.
I think we need to
agree to disagree.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you for calling, Michael.
Okay.
So I'd like to also remind our viewers that we will be meeting at the RAM at the North or at the Northgate RAM at 4:30 following the show, and you're welcome to join us.
Yeah. Heck yeah. If you want to call us to talk about your favorite Star Trek episode, or if you just want to. Don't come if you're going to call us nerds and laugh at us. Please don't do that. I don't think you'll probably be wearing
I think I will still wear it.
You are going to wear it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. We'll probably have to sit at a different table than you.
Okay. No. I won't be offended.
No. Where were we at before? Oh, we was kind of talking about, we're kind of wrapping up here, so I want to know what your final thoughts you necessarily have on Star Trek and atheism and humanism.
Well, I was going to mention the one episode that, or the one clip that we didn't play was the one that was from The Skin of Evil, but it was essentially about a service for Tasha Yar, where right at the very end of the episode, Data asks Captain Picard, or says to him, I don't really feel a sense of loss for Tasha, but rather for myself, that in the case of the way he felt about her loss was that he just didn't feel that.
Right. So, yeah, okay. So it looks like we're wrapping up, but I'm glad you got to say that. And Jerry, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
I really appreciate you co-hosting with me. And everyone will see you at the RAM and engage.